Good afternoon and welcome to the Jason Rand Show on AM 770 KTTH, streaming on the KTTH smartphone app. Seattle Mayor Bruce Harrell got the memo. It is time to tax us into oblivion just to end homelessness. That is what's trending.
What's trending? The mayor's office.
I want you to go with me for a moment as I try to explain the position of Democrats as it relates to homelessness and the intersection of housing and homelessness. The left argues, whether it's in Seattle or nationwide, Democrats have decided to say that homelessness is a direct result of a lack of affordable housing. Did you get that memo?
Yes.
Yes. We all heard it. And it seems kind of sudden that they're all saying exactly the same thing. They didn't say lack of affordable housing created homelessness prior to COVID. It was sort of like COVID was the line in which they decided to shift completely into the world of there's not enough affordable housing. Now, I disagree with that position. I disagree. However, just for the sake of argument, let's assume that that is the case. And let us assume that the Democrats believe what they're saying. Okay. Housing affordability. It's too expensive. Causes home. Okay. They want more, quote unquote, affordable housing in Seattle. How they go about doing it is to triple the property tax for a housing levy in Seattle. So in other words, they are saying, we are going to charge you even more as a homeowner. Your taxes will go up. Triple what they are right now, specifically for a housing levy. And we're going to use those dollars to create more affordable housing. So go with me here one more time because it's a little confusing, right? Homelessness is created by lack of what?
Affordable housing.
What does it do to the cost of housing when you raise property taxes?
Increases it.
Okay. So an increase in housing affordability or the increase in cost of owning a home and living in a home, wouldn't that then cause more homelessness?
In theory, yes.
That's what they say. That's literally what they say. Is it possible, is it conceivable that when you raise taxes, it potentially, and again, just kind of go with me here, makes housing more unaffordable for a certain portion of the population?
Yeah.
Okay. According to their argument, what's going to happen to them?
They're going to be homeless.
Exactly. So they either don't believe what they're saying, or they have no clue what it is they're talking about. They have absolutely no clue what it is they're talking about. And yet that's the plan here in Seattle. Bruce Harrell announced a new proposal to move forward with the housing levy that ends at the end of, I believe, next year or the end of this year. He wants to triple it to bring in $970 million a year to build just 3,000 housing units, whatever that means in this context, and give some money to homeless groups and homeless outreach programs. $970 million. Did I get that right?
This levy will be a $970 million housing levy.
Say that one more. Wait, what? How much? I missed it.
One more time.
Hold on.
This levy will be a $970 million housing levy.
Why did he say it's like that?
I have no idea.
It's almost like he knew we were like, wait, how much? You're tripling it? Well, you're tripling our tax liability.
That was the only quote they put in the package. I think that was Como, right?
Yeah, Como TV. God bless them. This is what Como says. They did the math. They said the tax rate would be 45 cents per $1,000 assessed value. The cost of the median Seattle homeowner is estimated at about $383 per year based on an assessed value of $855,000. That's the median house price. So someone might say, someone who doesn't really pay close attention to these issues might say, especially renters, oh, well, so you can't afford an extra $383 a year, really. It's just $383. And if it was literally just $383, you would be right. For most people, I think you would be right. But it's not just $383. This is just one tax of the many, 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 many taxes that add up to thousands of dollars extra every single year. You cannot hold these two positions. They do not make sense. You cannot tell me that the higher the cost of living goes, the more homelessness is. You cannot say that while simultaneously telling us the only way to solve homelessness is to bring down the cost of living. They are in conflict. They're in conflict. Now, the housing levy that currently exists at a much lower rate houses people like Nicole Stanley. She and her husband, they've got, I think, two kids. And she offers an awful pitch for the housing levy to Como TV.
We're probably more of an average family in Seattle by, you know, we don't make $500,000 a year by working at, you know, Microsoft.
Okay. Como reports, and God bless her, that she thinks Microsoft is in Seattle, when of course it is not. It is in Redmond. She's talking specifically about Seattle. This is a Seattle-only levy. This has nothing to do with the $500,000 employee who doesn't quite exist the way that she thinks. You give me a $200,000, $150,000, okay, I'll go with you. The $500,000, there's some of them, but that's not the majority. Her argument is that they just can't afford to live here, and that's not fair. That does not mean you will be homeless, right?
Yeah.
She's basically saying, yeah, it's a little bit too expensive for me. Now, according to the story, she and her husband, they both have jobs, full-time jobs, and they moved here 10 years ago. With respect, we're not in the business of just providing anybody affordable, quote-unquote, affordable housing. You can't afford a house right now. You can afford rent. Don't tell me you can't get rent. You've got two jobs, two people living in the household with two kids. You've got jobs apiece. You don't have to live right in the middle of Seattle. You don't have to live on Capitol Hill where it's more expensive, or Ballard where it's more expensive. You don't have to live there. I feel for anybody who's working hard and is saving money and they want to be able to purchase a home, right? It's expensive. There's no doubt. And for someone who works in a restaurant or a warehouse or what have you, yeah, it's going to take a long time for you to get the money you need to purchase a home in Seattle. Then don't purchase a home in Seattle. It's really that simple. You do not have a right, despite what folks on the left tell you, to housing wherever it is you want it. You don't. And at some point, you have to be an adult. And adults work, save money, make smart decisions, act responsibly, and eventually you go off on your own. And you're supposed to be self-sufficient. We cannot afford a whole bunch of Nicoles. Again, God bless her. I have nothing against her. But at some point, why is it up to us to make her life just a little bit more comfortable and not say Max? Why doesn't Max get an affordable house, quote unquote? Why are we paying for him? You're working full time, just like Nicole and her husband. You're a single person. Get you a studio apartment. We don't need to get you a three-bedroom house or two, but whatever it is. Why is it that we're picking Nicole over you? Why would we pick you over Nicole?
Because I'm better than her.
But you're not. Well, that's definitely not true. I mean, let's be honest. No.
Oh. You saw her. Well, I don't know.
Does she have green hair?
No, she doesn't. She's somewhat normal looking.
I feel like that's not true now. I don't know why you would mention if I saw her.
Well, I don't like you thinking that she's better than me.
It's not based on looks.
Well, I didn't say it was.
I mean, even if it was, I would still say that about her, but it's not about looks. They write, Stanley and her husband had been saving up to buy a house ever since they moved to Seattle more than 10 years ago. But it quickly was seeming more like an impossible dream until they were accepted to move into a home funded by the current levy, which is set to expire this year.
Knowing that no one can raise our rent by an extra $1,000 if they feel like it, and having to move with two little kids that, you know, love the neighborhood is everything.
Yeah, that sucks. I get it. But that's for everybody. It's literally for everybody. So what makes her in a position where she's deserving of tax dollars? Look, if you want to live like this, if you want this to be the norm, donate to charity, donate to a nonprofit that does exactly the same thing. This is not the role of the government. Seriously, it's not the role of the government. At what point do we say, you are on your own, we'll help you if you need it, but she's not in a position where she actually needs it. if she's not paying rent or it's paying very, very, very low rent, because I don't know how this particular program with her works, but let's say part of it is getting subsidized, a huge chunk. Well, what are you doing with all the extra money? There are other people who are exactly in the same position that she is who are not getting this. And maybe that's the end goal. Maybe the end goal is getting to a point in which the government just buys everyone a house. And it's paid for by rich people who apparently don't also have to pay for their own home. We're going to put them in subsidized housing. I don't know how it's going to work. We're going to knock down all the big homes and put down little tiny, what are those, apartments or micro apartments. Ugh, let's find out what else is trending.
What's trending at the movies?
It's Friday. You know what that means? It means I get to talk movies. And a big weekend release is Dungeons and Dragons Honor Amongst Thieves. It stars Chris Pine as a likable, affable thief looking to steal a relic that can bring one person, just one person, back from the dead. Now, along with his trusted and loyal warrior friend, played by Michelle Rodriguez, an insecure wizard, played by Justice Smith, and a resourceful and confident elf shapeshifter, played by Sophia Lillis, they take on a journey across their mythical land, running into obstacles, and even a friend who might be willing to cross them for the wrong reasons. Here, the gang interrogates a long-deceased man who could help them find this relic.
Once the dead man is revived, we can ask him 5 questions, at which point he will die again, never to be re-revived.
Why 5 questions?
I don't know, that's just how it works. It
seems arbitrary.
Can we get on with this, please?
Right, yes. Perlamon Tergatis. Maybe I'm not saying it right. I wasn't scared, nearly startled.
Here we go. Were you killed in the Battle of the Everhorse?
Yes.
Great. I mean, not for you. Sorry for your loss. Formal question, right?
Yes.
No, that wasn't for you. Did that count as a question?
Yes.
Damn it. Only answer when I talk to you, okay?
Yes.
Why did you say okay at the end of that?
I didn't.
Fantastic. Where's the shovel?
Okay. So the majority of the film includes what we'll call mini quests, because they're searching for this relic, and just like in a video game, you have to go through certain rounds in order to get closer to your end goal. For this, it introduced us to some pretty memorable characters. I think it's easy to dismiss Dungeons & Dragons as a frivolous, silly film that's not worth seeing because it's based on a video game. I would not miss it if I were you. It has no business being as good as it is, and I am so glad that I gave it a shot. It is legitimately laugh-out-loud funny. I had so much fun in this movie. It's charming, it's witty, and it's very knowing. It's a film that at times comes with sort of a wink and a nod, and it works so effectively. But like so many other adventure comedies that work, this was a movie that had a heart. And I don't think anyone other than Chris Pine could pull off this role. His emotional journey, he's fighting for a dead loved one. He's trying to win back the affection of his daughter who no longer trusts him. It seems so genuine and warm. And it ends up elevating this film past just a fun movie that passes a couple hours. You really get something out of it. Now, I'm assuming you don't have to be familiar with the game, since I'm not familiar with the game other than knowing about it. I imagine there are probably plenty of references that would have the Dungeons and Dragons nerds all excited, but I don't think it's necessary. I absolutely love Dungeons and Dragons Honor Amongst Thieves. I highly recommend you check it out this weekend. It's rated PG-13, although I do think most kids will be fine in this film. So I think you should bring them. Check out Dungeons & Dragons Honor Amongst Thieves. What movie are you going to see this weekend? Send me a text, 1-800-465-8770. Let's find out what else is trending.
What's trending? You can't make this up.
There is a story on Reddit that is absolutely hysterical. And it was posted in a subreddit known as AITA. Am I the bleep hole? I find that hysterical already. They're basically people posing questions saying, here's what I did, here's what happened. Am I the one who's the... And I don't know the answer to this.
This is a good one. This is a good
really
one.
Good. Involves an 18-year-old guy. He said he was traveling back home from the United States to wherever his home country was. It didn't mention. And he had just boarded a second connecting flight, which he said would last roughly 12 hours. So I'm guessing it's either a country in Africa or in Asia. It's got to, just based on the two connecting flights, that's pretty significant. He said, quote, "I had the delightful sight of an obese man who was taking up a good chunk of my seat. I'm not a small guy myself. I have quite broad shoulders, and I'm around 190 centimeters, which also should give us a clue. That's about 6'3". So a full seat would already have been uncomfortable. I told the flight attendant about this issue, and she told me that the seat was paid for by this obese person, and the flight was full. I asked the flight attendant how it's possible that my seat still rendered as available if it was being used for someone's literal roles. I then added on how this airline wasn't absolutely terrible just a few years ago. They just went downhill in quality. These comments prompted the flight attendant to call me rude and just made her double down on having me kicked off the plane. Though she reassured me I'd be compensated for this trouble, as I told her I wasn't traveling for vacation. He then says, the fat man took his opportunity to call me a fatphobic bleep. Some other people around me gave me the stink eye. I know they think I'm a bad person for this, but on the other hand, I'm having to pay for the lack of discipline of another person as well as this bleep airline's booking system. The airline staff sent a letter of complaint that I got appealed, and the consequences in the complaint, being a temporary ban, were removed less than an hour later. Wow, he got a temporary ban for that. In the letter of complaint, it said I was being rude to other passengers and the staff. Since it got appealed so quick, and I got to travel the next day anyway, I'm really not sure if I'm the bleep. He's not wrong, but he handled it poorly. You probably don't just go up and say, hey, Fatty McFatface over here is bleeding into my or rolling into my seat. Get Fatty over there. Get him somewhere else. Like, probably don't do that. That's not an appropriate way. But something tells me that the guy who, the obese man, goes through this a lot, and he's a victim of the body positivity movement. You know why? One word he used. What word did he use? Not the bad word, the other one. Fatphobic.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Normal people don't use that term, right? The everyday average person doesn't use that term. No one says that.
Doesn't that literally mean you're afraid of fat people?
Yeah.
Which...
that's what he
misses
said.
The point.
Yes, it does. But I mean, activists use that term.
Yeah.
Within the body positivity movement. You're fat phobic. Normal, average people don't say that, which makes me root for the skinny kid a little bit more. He's not wrong. I don't blame the airlines. I did a segment on this with Kennedy the other 3 weeks ago. And I think it was either Spirit or Frontier, one of the bad ones. They're both bad, so I don't know, remember. But she brought up, it wasn't even related to this, but she brought up travel and how she doesn't like it when someone who's obese is, you know, literal roles going into your row. What are you supposed to do? I was like, I get that, but what is the airline supposed to do? You can't get mad at the airline for that. Are they collecting everyone's weight? Is that what they're supposed to do? Is before you get on board, as you're buying your ticket, tell us your weight, and so we can determine whether or not you should get two seats. I don't get it. It's not their fault. If you have a full flight, I feel bad for the 18-year-old. There's no doubt. It's uncomfortable for 12 hours. But what else is supposed to happen?
Yeah, you want the flight attendant to go up to the big dude and say, hey, man.
Kick them off the flight?
Yeah, or, I mean, I guess the kid probably wanted some other accommodation, right? He probably wanted a different seat if there was an empty seat or something like that,
yeah,
right?
And she said that apparently the flight attendant said that there wasn't. I will also point out the fat phobic guy, or the guy who declares one fat phobic, the fatty, McFatface. He's also 100% in the wrong because he also knows the truth.
Yeah.
Not his first time on a flight.
But, I mean, if you're Mr. Fatty, do you want to have to pay for two seats?
Yeah,
do you want to have to pay? Are you going to do that?
That's on him.
Just out of the kindness of my heart, since I'm so fat, I'm going to buy two seats.
That's my point. It's on him. He's the one who did the wrong thing.
Being fat is the wrong thing?
No, buying one ticket when you know that it's not going to be comfortable for the people around you. It depends on the airline, because not all airlines have armrests that go up. Not all of them do that.
Oh, yeah.
I don't even know. I couldn't tell you the last one that I've been, a plane that I've been on that has the armrest that moves.
Like a normal person.
It's true. But even in first class, no, that's not true. Everything moves. No, the armrests don't move in first class.
Well, yeah, in coach they do.
Do they?
I can't remember the last time I was on a flight where they didn't.
Oh, okay. That's so funny.
Well,
that's the difference between travel, you and I.
You know the ones that have the little TV screen that pops out of the armrest? Mm-hmm. I don't think those ones move.
Okay. But you're saying that in coach, they do normally move. Okay, then that's
most of the time, yeah.
Okay, never mind. Then Fatty McFatface should go into first class. You get a bigger seat, and you don't have to worry about anyone sitting next to you. The person sitting next to you is you know, you've got a lot of room between you two. But I was going to say, if they don't move up, then you shouldn't have to pay for two seats, because that's not fair. What are you supposed to do? You can't make your one seat larger by sitting in two if the armrest doesn't go up. That's all. 1-800-465-877 if you want to send me a text. At 4:45, we allow you to pick the news. You get to vote on which story I cover. Story number one, pro-democracy Arizona Democrats sue to block a third party from the ballot. Oh, the irony. Story number two, California may end ban on travel to GOP states after the law backfires. Which story do you want me to cover? Text 1-800-465-8770.
Mercer Island, Des Moines.
This is the Big Local on the Jason Ranch Show.
Shoreline, Woodinville, Burien.
Stories about you, not about Seattle.
Look at that. It's 4:30 on a weekday afternoon, and that means it's time for the Big Local, brought to you by Alpine Specialty Services, online at alpineclean.com. It's part of the show where we completely ignore all those stories coming out of Seattle, and instead we focus on the communities you live in and care about most. We start in Everett, where the degenerate who murdered an Everett police officer is now using the BLM defense, claiming PTSD from prior run-ins with police. Richard Rotter is on trial for the shooting of Officer Dan Rocha, who he then ran over in a car as he was fleeing the scene. The officer, of course, lost his life. Yesterday, a psychologist testified for the defense and told the jury that she had diagnosed Rotter with PTSD because, according to her, he was previously tackled and injured by cops. Dr. Wendy Watchsmith.
He had been involved with the police on a couple of occasions that during which he was injured and ended up in the hospital.
Mm-hmm. She said Rotter was likely triggered by the fear and trauma of being in front of an officer, which is exactly how BLM activists have justified use of violence against cops or justified hatred against cops. Oh, they get triggered when they see an officer. I mean, because, you know, systemic racism and whatnot. Now, the prosecution, of course, got a chance to question this doctor. The testimony went on for about 4 hours yesterday. And they actually kind of had a pretty simple question for her. She's saying, of course, that he was triggered by the officer, just seeing a cop. It brought up all the memories of the trauma. This was someone who, you know, had to react the way that he did, not because he planned it, not out of malice, but because of this PTSD. Well, there is body camera footage of what happened. And so the prosecutor was all like, have you watched it? Did you watch all the body camera footage before you came to the conclusion that he has PTSD?
You did not look at that video, did you?
No.
don't you think on a case like this, where you're going to be offering an opinion like that you did, that you have an obligation to look at every bit of relevant information that might have relevance to your ultimate conclusion?
I do, and I feel like I did.
Really? You feel like you did? You've got the video of what happened the day that you claim the PTSD was triggered inside of him. Wouldn't you want to see that and try to get a better understanding as to how he acted? And is the way he acted consistent with other patients you've seen who have PTSD? I hope they get a refund on that witness. My God. I'm assuming they paid her. Which, by the way, is normal. But, you know, get one who's going to watch the video evidence. My God. Now, the defense argued that Rotter was on top of everything, heavily under the influence of drugs at the time of the shooting, causing him even more agitation and paranoia when he was stopped, according to Como TV. Okay. You still should go to jail for the rest of your life because you murdered someone. I don't care you were on drugs. That's a you problem. Oh, you got triggered? Oh, okay. That doesn't mean you get to murder someone. This is a degenerate who belongs in jail. He belongs on death row, but we don't have that in Washington State anymore. And unfortunately, the reality is no matter what sentence he gets, he'll probably still be out in 25 years. He'll probably still be out in 25 years. Now, they said today was likely going to be the end of the case, that they were going to rest the defense. I haven't seen that come across our news desk yet, but they say it's likely imminent, which means we might be able to get a verdict, I guess, possibly Monday if they truly end today, but more likely mid to end of the week. Hopefully they just do what's right, say he's guilty, throw him in jail, and let's forget about him until 25 years passes, in which we then have to say, hey, thanks, Democrats, you just let out a cop killer. Meanwhile, Lake Forest Park Police Department on their Facebook page said a burglar broke into an apartment complex. The resident who lived in said apartment complex shot him and killed him. Shot the burglar. Burglar dies at the scene. Now, there's nothing really more to this story. That's it. That's the totality of what the Lake Forest Police Department posted. It had some small details about the location, the apartment complex name. You don't need that. But you don't really need more to this story. You really don't. But dare I say this? The more that things like this occur, where bad guy tries to do something bad, good guy protects himself, herself, and his or her family, the less likely it is that the bad guy is going to engage, or future bad guys will engage, in that exact kind of behavior. That if all of a sudden there were a rash of burglars getting shot by armed residents, the victims, if that was happening all of a sudden, it might disincentivize someone from committing a burglary in the same way. I don't think there's a single person, any responsible gun owner, who wants to be put in a position where they have to defend themselves with their gun. They'll get training. They'll learn the law. All so that they can be responsible in the moment. Should they be called to action? But no one wants to do that. I don't want to do that. I'm going to take, as soon as I get my CPL delivered to me, I'm going to self-defense courses at West Coast Armory North, sponsor of the show. They do amazing training. I'll leave that training saying, I hope I never have to use this, because that would mean I'm in danger or someone around me is in danger. But I do think people need to be smart. They're going to have to defend themselves the way that they need to, mitigate the risks, whatever that means to you, as long as you're doing it responsibly, safely, by the law. More power to you. I'm just saying, the more stories like this, the better it is to end this crime surge. The reason why you're seeing so many people breaking into pot shops, for example, stealing cars, running them into storefronts, is because they're seeing other people do that and then getting away with it. And so they say, oh, well, they're getting away with it. I'm way smarter than that dude. Let me do it. And then they do it and they get away with it. And then the story is reported and it inspires somebody else. So the more stories like this, the better it is, frankly, to mitigate some of the risks. Because I know if I'm a criminal and I'm seeing that all of a sudden in the crime that I'm committing or the field of crime that I'm committing, all of a sudden people are getting pushback from armed residents. Yeah, I'm going to rethink. I'll rethink whether or not I'm going to break into another home. I might still commit a crime, right? I might break into a car or something. But I'd rather, if we're choosing between someone breaking into your home or your car, I think most of us would say break into the car. Obviously, if we're home especially. So we'll see. Finally, Olympia schools are making budget cuts. We told you about that earlier in the week. They've got a $11.5 million shortfall. They're kind of waiting on the state budget, see where that is for a little bit of guidance on what they end up cutting. But they know that they're going to have to make some significant cuts to programs, to staff. They might be getting rid of middle school sports. We know that they're going to reduce the paraeducator staff by 26%. They already said that. They're going to increase the class sizes for all students only by about 5%. So that's not the worst thing in the world. But they're also going to eliminate art teachers at every single elementary school, which, let's be honest, it's fine.
They can, somebody can teach them to finger paint.
Yeah, so I just, you know, I don't think art is, or the arts are useless, but art class in an elementary school level, let's be
honest. If you're making cuts, that's probably one of the things that's probably pretty agreeable.
I'm not going to cut math. I'm not going to cut science. How else will they learn that math is racist and biology is sexist?
Especially in Olympia.
So, kind of my point. I would obviously cut the art as well. I would sooner cut art class and, you know, band or jazz or whatever instead of sports, because I think you learn something in sports. But parents are now starting to speak up and they're concerned. I totally get that. Sarah's a parent. She spoke with Cairo 7 TV. She's not a fan.
When you hear Olympia School District, you think of, you know, positive and great reputation. And so to think about there not being arts or sports for our kids, that's a disappointment.
100%. I'm with you. It's a disappointment. Then hold your district more accountable. How many stories have we done on the Olympia School District being woke to an absurd degree?
Seems like 100.
Right? We've done a lot. We've done a ton. This is the district that put on its school board the anti-police activist who encouraged people to riot. Okay? When you decide that you care more about the wokeness, more about social justice, more about a political position, you are failing these kids. And certainly, COVID and the lockdowns and the, not the school boards necessarily, but the school unions, the teacher unions, they were the ones who said, we should keep the schools closed even longer. And that pushed a lot of kids out, or parents decided to pull their kids. That played a role, there's no doubt. But I also think the whole wokeness played a role. When you start paying a little bit more attention to what's being taught to your kids, and you're realizing instead of learning math and science and English and history, you're being told to become basically left-wing activists. You're told that there are 12,000 different genders. You're told that all white people are racist and that systemic white supremacy still permeates every inch of our society. At some point, the parents are going to be like, yeah, I don't want my kid learning that. I'm a liberal parent, but I kind of want to make sure I'm setting up my kid for success in the future. This is the result. This is the end result. It's the end result of the problems in Bellevue, the end result of the problems in the city we don't talk about in this segment. So for all the parents who are upset about this, and again, you should be, look at what your school board has done and look at what your schools have done, the principals have done, and tell me if they've been acting in the best interest academically of your kids or if they've been leaning into the politics. If they've been leaning into the politics, even if you agree, that's the reason why more and more kids are leaving schools. You may keep your kid in there because you like it, but know that that's why they're leaving. 1-800-465-8770 for your text messages. You get to pick the next story in the next segment that I discuss. Story number one, pro-democracy Arizona Democrats sue to block the third party from the ballot. Or California may end a ban on travel to GOP states after the law backfires. What should I talk about? I wonder. Send me your text with your answer. 1-800-465-8770.
pick the topic on the Jason Rand Show.
This one was a pretty significant winner, pretty clear winner. They went with story number two. California may end the ban on travel to 23 GOP states after the law backfires. Now, may end. I don't know if they're actually going to end. In fact, they probably won't. Virtue signaling doesn't always pay. It tends to have unintended consequences. Ask any lawmaker on the left who declared their city or county or state a sanctuary for illegal immigrants, only to then learn illegal immigrants might actually show up in droves. And then all of a sudden you're like, wait, what? Gavin Newsom banned government funding to travel or for travel to the states that have abortion restrictions that he doesn't like. So we're talking about Texas, for example. Gavin Newsom is someone who's pro-abortion. He's not pro-choice. He's pro-abortion. There's a difference. But before they even put this law into place, they had another one that said, hey, North Carolina, we don't like you because of your bathroom bill that says women should use a woman's bathroom and men should use a men's bathroom. So we don't want you folks traveling there either. We got a ban in place. So the state now is at 23 GOP states that they've banned government-funded travel to. But now a state senator in California is saying, whoa, 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 whoa. Y'all realize that this means the San Diego State men's basketball team, they can't travel to Texas for the Final Four this weekend because we can't legally put any money into the travel. How are we supposed to get them there? Now, ultimately, the NCAA said they were going to pay. But I can't imagine that's going to be the rule. This is probably the exception to the rule. If we're talking about any sports team going into a tournament outside of the Final Four, which is obviously a big deal and you'll get the funding. But for everybody else, they're kind of screwed if you go to a public school. So the state senator, her name is Toni Atkins. She's pushing a bill that overturns the regulations, but because she's a Democrat, she's still in favor of going after states that have laws she does not like. So what she's saying is we should get rid of these regulations, allow people to travel, government funded, wherever it is they want. However, we should use the money for an ad campaign that talks about how inclusive we are. I mean, that's a woke virtue signaling wet dream for people like Gavin Newsom. Hey, we're going to put a ton of money into ads talking about how woke you are, how amazing you are, how you stand up for women's rights. That's what she's arguing should be done instead. Now, her idea for now seems dead on arrival. Doesn't seem like it's going to go anywhere. You've got way too many officials in California who still support the ban. But there are some people who are saying, I kind of see your point. It's not a large number yet, but you just need a few members in the state House or state Senate who are Democrats to step up when I'm presuming you're going to have the support of the Republicans. So, I mean, there is a significant imbalance of power there, but, you know, it's certainly possible that you don't need to convince all the Democrats. You just need to convince enough Democrats, depending on the numbers. What I love about a story like this, not only does it show that the virtue signaling doesn't pay and it has unintended consequences, the thing is, it shows the difference between a red state and a blue state. Red states don't ban travel to blue states with the exception of being defensive, meaning you did this to us, we're going to respond and do the same thing to you. But I can't tell you any state that has red state that has proactively like been the aggressor. I just don't think that those states exist. I haven't seen any, or at least I can't recall any. Texas, in this case, they don't care whether or not government-funded travel is used to get someone from California to Texas. They don't care. You don't control their economy. Travel from a California government official or an arm of the government, that doesn't impact the economy at all. In fact, if not a single Californian went to Texas, outside of the people who are leaving California permanently to move to Texas, If that just ended today, they would be fine. You never hear a red state come out and say, hey, we don't like the bill you just passed in blue state Washington. Stay away. We don't want anything to do with you. They just don't take that position. We tend to be more open-minded in debating and talking to people with whom we disagree. I say that as a Washingtonian, right? I say that in the context of being a Republican in a city in which only four exist, right? So for me, I don't really have any other choice than to talk with people I disagree with or be around people who I know loathe me. And that's just my coworkers I'm talking about. Now, I imagine if you come from, you can answer this, Oklahoma, although depending on where you are in Oklahoma, you could jump into little blue pockets, I guess. College
small,
pockets.
Yeah.
Pockets. But do they hold that position? If you're surrounded by a whole bunch of conservatives, are you as aggressive towards people who disagree with you as leftists are in Seattle?
No, they
right?
They really weren't.
I just never get that impression from folks on the right. They exist. There's some of them, sure. But I'm saying as a culture, Republicans generally are okay with open debate. They'll disagree, and they'll disagree passionately. We always will. And some issues will get more passionate pushback than others. But for the most part, we're happy to discuss issues and debate issues and not take it all that personally. But the leftists, oof. Wish I could say the same about them. 1-800-465-8770 if you want to send me a text. Congressman Andy Biggs of Arizona stops by to discuss the Trump indictment, this political attack, and what it means for the legal system. We're going to get to that and so much more in the next hour of the Jason Rand Show.